From KCRW, this is DNA Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. 80 years ago to this day, rain started pouring on Los Angeles. Floods washed out roads, bridges, and thousands of homes and many lives. The devastation led to total channelization of the river that would forever shape Los Angeles.
The river serves as sort of a demarcation. It's a line drawn in the concrete sand, as it were. And the bridge you could traverse from one social environment to another.
The river is a 51-mile spine that cuts through that second largest urban area in the United States.
So you'll have schools on one side and schools on the other side that would benefit from being connectable that are further away than ever.
Division and connection at the LA River. That's the focus of our show today. It's part of a series called Bridges and Walls that I've been working on with DNA producer Avishai Artsy.
And what's happening now at the river is a lot more connection. Last week, the Los Angeles City Council gave the thumbs up to a snazzy pedestrian bridge that will connect two neighborhoods once riven by gang wars.
This is just one of several new bridges, along with parks and housing and businesses, that really mark another era for the river.
But there are also worries about new kinds of separation.
I grew up here my entire life. Gentrification getting over here is really surprising and shocking because you don't want your community to change. You want home to stay home.
Our story starts in the river, under the Glendale Hyperion Bridge. This connects Atwater Village and Silver Lake, and it is one of the oldest bridges over the LA River.
And for musician Andrew Bird, this is a place of inspiration. I met him there. We took off our socks and shoes, rolled up our pants, and stepped into the water.
We're looking north to where it looks like they removed a bridge a while back. So you see these this canal. And then there's the wetlands in here that they put in. LA River was originally a natural river that then was turned into this concrete canal. And in the last 10 years or so, they've tried to reintroduce nature to a otherwise pretty bleak landscape. They've done a pretty good job.
Andrew's releasing a series of instrumental albums that mix field recordings and natural settings with music made in the studio. He's calling them echo locations. In this case, the echo comes from the sounds of his violin and his whistling bouncing off the concrete walls of the bridge.
I take the field recordings that I make in the space. I find the frequencies that are giving me the most information. I build compositions on those frequencies. For instance, I find these sort of swooping notes from D down to G are giving me a lot of information, you know. The reflections, the echo, the reverb is where I get the feedback from the environment. The wild bird life down here is pretty amazing. There's some fairly rare species. That's why I ended up naming the songs after musical sounding bird names.
Yeah, for example, the cormorants, lazuli bunting, black crowned night heron, killdeer, and the green heron. So you're very interested in sort of the way nature is putting itself back into the city.
Other than the faint smell of ammonia, it's I don't think the water's terribly, people would assume it's pretty nasty, but I think it's pretty clean actually. I try different techniques and see what the space, you know, the pizzicato with the whistling, you know. But what I found with these spaces is these swooping notes give me a really interesting feedback. Right away I noticed that it had kind of a post-apocalyptic sound to it, you know, that it's not acoustically perfect by any means. When I went back to my studio, I went more in a, I mean, it's ambient music, but I took it in a little more dystopian direction.
And right now, there's a convergence of efforts to make our river a lot less dystopian.
We're seeing the fruits of several decades of efforts by activists and advocates, city, county, and state agencies, artists, architects, landscape designers, developers and nonprofits, elected officials, and LA 2028 Olympic planners and the Army Corps of Engineers.
All to make 51 miles of concrete, that is in LA County, there's 32 miles within the city of LA, all to make our river more approachable, more usable, more natural, more friendly, and more unifying.
And the physical and metaphorical signifiers of this change are coming in the form of bridges.
So to get a sense of the change that's taking place now, let's just remember that the Glendale Hyperion Bridge, where Avishai met with Andrew, that was built 90 years ago during a period of intense bridge building.
But those bridges were designed for cars and for railroads. Now the goal is to create a new kind of connection for walkers, cyclists, even horse riders, and to embed those bridges in parks, big new green spaces for Angelenos.
Like the one the council signed off on last week. That's the Taylor Yard Bikeway and Pedestrian Bridge. You may have seen the images. It really does look fun, rendering Shirt as a bright orange kind of oversized box truss that'll slope from east down to west and has an outlook both ways in the middle. It was designed by an architect named Zoltan Pali, and he took inspiration, he says, from the industrial railroad bridges of the last century.
The end of the day is that if you look at the bridge and you look at the design of the bridge, it is not about heroics. It's about being as simple and as elegant as it possibly can be.
This bridge will connect two neighborhoods, Frogtown, otherwise known as Elysian Valley, to Taylor Yard, a former railway site in Cypress Park that is now being turned into a green park, and it would be for pedestrian and cyclists only, no cars allowed.
It also links two neighborhoods that were once divided by gangs.
We are connecting two neighborhoods, but these are perhaps two neighborhoods that, you know, at times had conflict, you know, sort of a place where, you know, you might get into a little tussle, but hopefully not. The idea is that you come to the middle of the bridge and there's two viewing platforms and you look north and south and there's a place hopefully to meet and have a nice quiet moment.
Actually, Zoltan has nicknamed this bridge Rumblefish after the Matt Dillon movie about rival gangs. It's not the official name, but connection is certainly the goal here.
There's a lot of bridge projects in the works. All are trying to make better connections.
This is Deborah Weintraub. She's Chief Deputy City Engineer for the City of Los Angeles. And she's overseeing many of these bridge projects. They include historic bridges over First Street, Spring Street, and Main Street that are being retrofitted for earthquake safety while adding amenities for walkers and cyclists. Then there are three new bridges that are being built in the Glendale Narrows stretch of the Los Angeles River. That's where you find more of the water and the grasses and the birds. That's where it's called Soft Bottom. And one of these bridges is for horses as well as walkers and bikes, and it's going to be a striking design.
It's going to be the first cable-stayed pedestrian bridge, which means it's going to have a tall mast pole in the middle of the river, and from that tall pole will be cables that come out and kind of swoops to either side of the bridge to structurally support the bridge. So it'll be a powerful visual marker on the river.
And then there's the flagship bridge at 6th Street that connects Boyle Heights and downtown's Arts District. This is the 6th Street Viaduct Replacement Project. It's replacing an older historic bridge that had to be taken down because of deterioration, a concrete cancer. So this new project is very evocative of the old bridge. It has 10 paired arches that leap 3,500 feet across the river.
And it's designed by the architect Michael Moltzen with HNTB. He's also the designer of One Santa Fe, we should say. That is the urban scale housing and retail project that borders the west side of the river, just upstream from 6th Street Bridge.
We spoke with him about the design at a big public farewell party on the original Art Deco-inspired bridge.
We're envisioning this bridge as taking on a greater responsibility of doing more as infrastructure in the city, and that means connecting not only from point A to point B, but becoming a destination that connects the flats underneath, makes the river that much more accessibility, ties together communities, and becomes a destination for celebration. Hopefully making a bridge that has as much spirit, as much life and liveliness as the current bridge does. And if we're successful, it'll continue to be really that backdrop for what represents the best and most creative in the city.
There are people who mourn the passing of the old 6th Street Bridge, but Deborah Weintraub says that new bridges can become new classics.
We're looking to do distinctive, cost-effective structures that provide both visual interest to the environment, but also create kind of social identifiers. And by far the most important, of course, is the Sixth Street Viaduct. But for even the smaller projects, for the Taylor Yard Bridge, which is this very large truss that you walk through, we're looking for each of these now to have a distinctive quality and style that reflects the same kind of concern that was given to the historic bridges that were built in downtown, the same emphasis on design in the public realm. Ultimately, when all is said and done and we all walk away, that's what's left for 100 years.
But where there is going to be a new experience is that some of these bridges are going to be bridges that people stop in the middle of and hang out and look at the views
of the river.
Of the river, yes. And beyond, because even the most lovely of the older bridges were primarily used by cars or by the red car or even by trains, I think, back in the day to speed over.
Yes, that is true. That is very true. There's a different kind of ambition in terms of the interaction that the public will have, we hope.
Right.
With a different ambition.
Now, there's another way in which these bridges have a new ambition. Several of them will spring out of parks. The Orange Taylor Yard Bridge, for example, and, of course, the 6th Street Viaduct Replacement Project, which is going to have a total of 12 acres of open space divided between both ends. So you'll have park in the Arts District and park in Boyle Heights.
So this does all sound great and a very positive development for both sides of the river, but there are some people who feel very anxious about these changes, and one of them is Harry Gamboa Jr. He's a conceptual artist, and he grew up in Boyle Heights.
And so the bridge, for instance, and the river has played a big role in the psyche of Los Angeles, and so most people would know the 6th Street Bridge from car commercials, and yet those that live within it and were affected by it view it with a different kind of an understanding, and then view the destruction of that bridge as the first assault of gentrification.
So he believes the new bridge and the park, however nice it is, will destabilize the neighborhood because of pressure from the more affluent arts district.
And he marked the demolition of the 6th Street Bridge with a series of what he calls photonovelas. A troupe of performers staged a series of dinners at the viaduct as it was being demolished.
And every time I would photograph, there would be less and less bridge to photograph. And did that for a year and a half. And in the end, I had all my performers, but all the bridge was gone. And the discussion was the process by which one can gather 100 people to perform and celebrate or to denounce the destruction of a cultural landmark and some way might provide a visualization of sort of this imbalance.
I think we're on the verge of what I call our pre-Highline moment in Los Angeles.
This is UCLA environmental historian John Christensen.
You know, with the coming of the Highline in New York City, wonderful, evocative, fun project. It also became a magnet for gentrification in those areas. And now there's the possibility that with the green improvements, new parks, there could come green gentrification that could see them being pushed out of their communities.
And we're going to find out exactly what he means by green gentrification later.
Before that, though, we're going to hear about why the river became a concrete gash through the city, bordered by some of the poorest communities in LA. That's coming up after this break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton.
And I'm Avishai Artsy, and we're talking about the LA River and the bridges and other developments that promise to mend a long-time divide.
That's the hope. But the river runs through some of the poorest neighborhoods in Los Angeles. And to understand how we got to this place, let's go back in time.
When the Native Americans lived in this region, there were floods. After all, this whole basin is a flood zone, and the river as we know it never used to follow a fixed route. Rather, its path moved and had many tributaries.
But as the next waves of Angelenos added more and more development near the river, houses and industry and rail yards, floods became a threat to life and property.
In 1914, there was a big flood. It triggered the formation of the County Flood Control District, which began constructing river channels and reservoirs.
Then a major flood struck on New Year's Eve of 1934. It killed over 100 people.
Woody Guthrie, the poet and troubadour, was living in Los Angeles around this time. He was a Dust Bowl refugee, and he saw many of his fellow Okies camped out alongside the rivers and creeks.
The name of this is the New Year's Flood. Kind friend, do you remember on that fatal New Year's night, the lights of old Los Angeles was a-flickering oh so bright. A cloudburst hit the mountains, it swept away our homes, and 100 souls was taken in that fatal New Year's flood.
Then, a few years after that fatal New Year's flood, came the deluge that changed L.A.
That's right, Francis. 80 years ago today, February 27th, 1938, the rains came, and they delivered almost a year's worth of precipitation in just a few days. The torrents of water flooded the Southland's rivers and washed out roads, bridges, and homes.
This devastation led to the total channelization of the LA River.
The Federal Flood Control Act was passed, and over the next 20 years, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and other agencies built flood control dams and debris basins and encased most of the river in concrete.
It became a wall between humans and nature and between West and East LA. It also became a favorite Hollywood movie location.
The rules are, there ain't no rules. It's to the second bridge and back, and the one who makes it here first wins.
Who can forget the drag racing scene in Grease?
Or the chase scene in Terminator 2 Judgment Day?
Or the far more sentimental scene in the movie Drive?
And it was also the video location for, appropriately being the theme of our series, Madonna's Borderline.
Hollywood has mythologized the LA River because what's more evocative of the urban jungle than a concrete river?
The river serves as sort of a demarcation. It's a line drawn in the concrete sand, as it were.
Now, artist Harry Gamboa Jr., he grew up in Boyle Heights, and for him, this concrete river was far more than just an edgy backdrop for movies, videos, and commercials.
Boyle Heights in itself, after the 1950s, had been reconfigured to be surrounded by freeways. The bridge and the river was very important to me because it actually did serve as a wall. But being the child that I was willing to scale any wall, destroy any wall, and spray paint any wall, and go through walls and transform walls until they were invisible.
And that's what Harry Gamboa Jr. did. And then came other graffiti artists like Saber.
Well, I painted the world's largest illegal wild style in history. I painted it at night, over 37 nights. Basically, it was over 126 gallons of rolling paint.
In 1997, Saber painted a huge artwork at the river's edge in downtown near the intersection of the 5 and 10 freeways. It was nearly the size of a football field, and it was visible from space.
And remained in place for a dozen years, but it was finally painted over in 2009 as part of a massive graffiti removal campaign.
They always try to deter people from painting down there, but because it was such a vast space, it opened up a certain adventurous mindset as a kid that was kind of, you really nowhere else had it. It was this endless channel. And so, and it had endless ways that you can go. And so what we would do as kids would find pockets that older dudes had found hidden areas to paint in. And the reason why Los Angeles got so good and so ahead in the progression of its graffiti techniques and wild style and painting was the fact that we had these hidden areas to go paint. The only thing, though, is with Los Angeles is you knew that you were encroaching into neighborhoods. So, like, you always had to have that knowledge of you better know where you are because like at any given time, anything can happen too. So that danger element was always present. And that kind of also made it adventurous even further.
Now, radio producer Jenna Cagle, she grew up in the valley and she saw the river as a kind of open-air gallery.
I specifically remember as a kid thinking about the LA River as this place where we would go and see graffiti. I would go down with my sister and it was just, you know, it wasn't just like a tag. It was like these beautiful pieces of art that was displayed all over different areas of the river. And especially what's unique about it is it didn't feel like this scary pit or scary place. You know, you often think about like an empty concrete, like underpass as a place where devious things are going on or nefarious things are going on. And it wasn't like that. It wasn't threatening. It wasn't scary. It was warm and exciting and a place to kind of learn things.
And this is the kind of strange story of the LA River. On the one hand, it's like this brutal concrete gash. And at the same time, it's a source of affection and inspiration, especially to artists like Saber.
It's the bowels of the city. But what I always found interesting was the architecture and how this entire area was constructed and then just kind of left to its own devices and just left. It was built to last, but then left to just get sun-drenched. And so only a certain type of person could survive down there. Only the strongest and the most reclusive could survive down there. And I would go down there by myself, you know, and which wasn't smart. And I'd go there at nighttime. And so one time this guy came out of nowhere, came up on top of me, and it was just me and him. And I got really scared. And I picked up the stick and I thought, oh, no, I'm going to have an altercation. And he got close and I could tell he was crazy. There was something happening in his mind. He just sat. And I said, well, I realized he wasn't quite a threat. And I said, okay, you know, do you want to talk? And he said, I would like to talk with you. And I said, okay. So he told me his story, and he just got out of county and was lost and had nowhere to go and didn't know what to do and just decided to go there and found me. So if you're lurking around the LA River and you get stopped and you're homeless and they decide to take you in, you get sucked into that system, I mean, it's impossible to come out of it. It is absolutely impossible. It is a grinding system. Next to the LA River, you have the world's largest jail facility. The world's largest jail facility is next to the LA River entrance.
Saber's referring to the LA County Jail Complex in downtown. It includes Men's Central Jail and Twin Towers Correctional Facility. Twin Towers first opened the year he painted his supersized piece.
Now, one artist who took on the brutal inequalities of Los Angeles is Judy Backer. She made one of the river's most famous installations, specifically in one of the river's tributaries, the Tujunga Wash Drainage Canal in the San Fernando Valley.
It's called the Great Wall of Los Angeles. It's a mural, half a mile long. It was started in 1974, and they're still working on it today.
Metaphorically, the Great Wall is a tattoo on the scar where the river once ran. And it came from a notion of a young man that I was working with in East Los Angeles who had a series of wounds on his body from gang warfare. He pulled up his shirt, he said, but look at me. I'm a map of scars. My body is a map of violence. And so I said to him, well, maybe we should transform them. He said, well, design me a tattoo, right? And it was that thought when I was standing on the river with the Army Corps of Engineers in 1974. And I thought, this is a scar where the river was. And we could tattoo that scar with an alternate vision of who we are.
That vision took the shape of a collective history of Los Angeles, told in paint by over 400 youth volunteers.
Participation was very essential to the very root of the idea of the Great Wall. The Great Wall was a reclamation of a story that had been disappeared, very much like the river had been disappeared. And I was a kid at the time that the rivers were not all entirely concreted, and they were open spaces where we could go and play. And as they became concreted, we lost those kind of spaces. As they became concreted, they also divided communities. They created, you know, a fast flow of pollution to the bay. And at the same time, the loss of one's history and one's story.
That's Judy Backer. She's the artistic director and founder of Social and Public Art Resource Center, or SPARC, in Venice.
Now, while she was humanizing the channel with paint, another Angelina was drawn by the siren song of the flood control channel.
I started Friends of the Los Angeles River as a 40-year artwork to bring the river back to life. I'd been involved in poetry and politics, and this brought that together for me.
In 1986, Lewis McAdams famously cut through the wire fencing with a couple of friends, and they asked the river for permission to speak on its behalf.
McAdams says, "We didn't hear no."
Why did it? It's hard to know. You know, it's it was something about wanting to bridge the species, to create a community, a larger community than just people.
Part of the challenge initially for Lewis McAdams was simply linguistic, to rename the flood control channel a river.
I mean, part of our role has always been to make the invisible visible, and that's the nature of the work, because the river was invisible, and now it's less so every day.
Lewis McAdams' group, Friends of the L.A. River, or FOLAR, became a huge advocacy group with thousands of members. They helped push for the L.A. River Revitalization Master Plan, which was a big planning document a decade ago, and for federal support to green the river.
Fast forward to now, and you'll find bike lanes aligning parts of the river, people are kayaking, and they're making music inspired by the river, like Andrew Bird. And they're camping at the river. Kat Superfisky was at the first camp that was officially allowed at the state-owned Bowtie Parcel.
The river is a 51-mile spine that cuts through that second largest urban area in the United States and outlets into the largest water body on the planet. That's significant. And so we, as the next generation, have this amazing opportunity to actually utilize the river as this kind of laboratory of sorts to figure out how to bring together a bunch of different demographics, how to think about ecology at the same time as the economy, and at the same time as the people living around there, and at the same time as education and art and all of those things. All of those different threads of life are woven together in the LA River. It's just waiting to be unearthed.
Kat Superfisky works with landscape architect Mia Lehrer, and she has won the commission to turn an old railroad site at the river into a park. But this is one of the parks that's bringing a new concern that some are calling green gentrification.
That's right, Frances. And we're going to get more into the redevelopment of the river and some of those anxieties on next week's program. And we're also going to hear more about what Frank Gehry's up to at the river with LA County. It involves the entire 51-mile flood control channel.
The river and the freeways cut cities in half, cut Long Beach in half, cut some of these communities in half. And so you'll have schools on one side and schools on the other side that would benefit from being connectable.
And we'll find out whether Frank Gehry thinks the concrete should stay or go.
The million-dollar question.
Solving the health problems and the open space problems and the water reclamation, all of that, are really top priority, beyond design, beyond what my feelings are. I don't think what I think about how it should look matters.
I'm Frances Anderton.
And I'm Avishai Artsy, and you've been listening to the fourth episode in our series Bridges and Walls on DNA, Design and Architecture.
You can hear past episodes at kcrw.com/bridgesandwalls. Today's episode was scored by Avishai Artsy and mixed by JC Swatek. Special thanks to Jenna Cagle and Caroline Chamberlain.
Bridges and Walls is supported in part by the California Arts Council, a state agency. Learn more at arts.ca.gov. And special thanks to NPR Story Lab.